Chapter 3. When a pair of North Korean agents from the brutal State Safety and Security Agency came to fetch their Syrian clients, two were quietly reading their Qurans while the third studied spec sheets for the Nodong missile. A guard made a gesture for the trio to follow that also showed off a pistol in a shoulder holster. Cabrillo and Hali Kasim tucked away their Qurans while Hanley slipped the schematics back into his bulky briefcase and thumbed the locks. They threaded their way through the Asia Star, a Panamanian-registered bulk carrier converted to the container trade. While worn, the interior spaces were well-maintained, and the bulkheads were glossy with new paint. The ship also appeared deserted except for the pair of spies on escort duty. At a hatchway below the main deck, one of the guards undogged a hatch. Beyond loomed a darkened steel cavern that smelled faintly of bilge water and old metal. The man snapped on banks of overhead lights, and the fluorescent glow revealed the 10 Nodong missiles settled into special cradles, their outlines blurred by thick plastic sheeting. Each missile was 62 feet in length and 4 feet in diameter, and weighed 15 tons when loaded with liquid fuel. Based on the venerable Russian Scud-D, the Nodong could carry a 1-ton payload nearly 600 miles. In the dank hold of the freighter, the shrouded rockets didn't lose any of their aura of menace or death. And knowing what was planned for two of these missiles deepened the resolve of the corporation members. The three men descended a set of metal stairs to the cargo hold's floor. Max Hanley, in the guise of the missile expert, stepped boldly to the first rocket. He barked at the government minders holding back at the hatchway and indicated that he wanted the plastic removed from the Nodongs. General Kim arrived just as Max had removed an access panel from the first missile and was bent over the opening with a circuit tester.
"I see you couldn't wait to inspect your newest weapons."
"They are formidable," Cabrillo replied for lack of anything else to say.
"Our experts have greatly improved on the old Soviet design, and the warheads are much more powerful."
"Which two are to be offloaded in Somalia?"
The North Korean repeated the question to one of the guards, who pointed out a pair of the rockets near the back of the hold.
"Those two under the red plastic. Because of the primitive facilities available in Mogadishu, the warheads have already been mounted. Fuel for those two can be loaded from the tanks in the forward hold in order to meet the tight schedule for firing, provided you don't add the corrosive mixture too soon. 3 days from Somalia is soon enough."
"I think 1 day is safer," Juan countered. He knew that Kim's statement had been a test of his knowledge of the missiles. Loading the liquid fuel 3 days before launch would cause it to dissolve the rocket's thin aluminum tanks and likely blow the Asia Star out of the water.
"Where is my head? Forgive me. Any more than 1 day would be disastrous."
There was little warmth in Kim's apology. Silently, Cabrillo hoped the general would remain on board when the missiles blew. Max Hanley called him over to see something within the Nodong's electronic brain. Hali Kasim stood at his other shoulder, and for 15 minutes the three men mutely stared into the tangle of wires and circuits. As they'd intended, they could hear Kim impatiently shifting his weight from foot to foot and muttering to himself.
"Is there something the matter?" he finally asked.
"No, all seems in order," Cabrillo answered without turning.
They played the game again for another 15 minutes. Occasionally, Max would consult a detail from the plans he carried, but other than that, the men remained as statues.
"Is this really necessary, Colonel Harani?"
Kim asked with ill-disguised impatience. Cabrillo ran a finger along his false mustache to make sure it was in place before turning.
"I am sorry, General.
Mr. Mohammed and Professor Khalidi are very thorough. Although I believe once they satisfy themselves that the first missile is in working order, they will be quicker with the others."
Kim shot a look at his watch.
"I can take this opportunity to attend to some paperwork in the captain's cabin. Why don't you find me when you have completed your inspection?"
These men will remain with you, should you need anything.
Wan suppressed a grin.
As you wish, General Kim.
The three members of the corporation moved on to the second missile 10 minutes later. The two guards had sat themselves on the stairs overlooking the hold. One smoked a continuous chain of cigarettes while the other watched the Arabs without seeming to blink. Both kept their suit jackets opened enough to reach their weapons. Kim might have grown bored with the operation, but the pair of secret policemen maintained their vigilance. There was no set time to rendezvous with Eddie Seng. If everything had gone according to plan, he would have the mini-sub positioned a short way from the Star's stern, close enough for the craft's sophisticated passive sonar to detect the sound of the three men hitting the water. The time constraint Wan felt came from his desire to get the Oregon as far into international waters as he could before first light. Dawn was 3 hours away. He calculated the time it would take to board the mini-sub, make their escape from Yonghungman Bay, and link up with the Oregon. From that point on, it would depend on the ship's magnetohydrodynamic engines, in which Cabrillo placed his full trust. The technology of using free electrons extracted from seawater to power the vessel was still in its experimental stages, but in the 2 years since taking delivery, the complex system of cryo-cooled magnets that generated power to feed pumps for her four pulse aqua jets had never let him down. It was time. Cabrillo felt a slight twinge in his stomach, not fear exactly, but a tension brought on by his old nemesis, Murphy's Law. It was almost a religion to him. He was a superb tactician and strategist, as well as a master planner, but he also recognized the vagaries of chance, an obstacle that can never be overcome entirely. The operation had gone smoothly to this point, which only increased the possibility of something fouling now. He had no doubt they could maintain their ruse until the ship reached Somalia, where they could easily escape. But that would mean failure, another of Cabrillo's old adversaries, one he hated even more than Mr. Murphy's famous precept. But he knew that once they committed, there would be no turning back. If the dice fell the wrong way, he and Max and Holly would die. Eddie Seng might stand a chance to escape, but it wasn't likely. However, if Lady Luck held, in a couple of hours, $10 million would appear in the corporation's Cayman Islands account, courtesy of Uncle Sam's black budget. Cabrillo tapped his watch, their prearranged signal, and suddenly the anxiety vanished. Wan went on automatic, relying on skills first learned in the ROTC, then honed at the CIA's training facility in rural Virginia before being perfected by 15 years in the field. Halley shifted his position slightly, blocking the guard's view of Hanley as Max snapped a hidden set of locks in his case. Wan turned from the missile, caught the eye of the guard with the nicotine addiction, and made a universal gesture of wanting to borrow one of his cigarettes. He started across the hold as the North Korean pulled a nearly depleted pack from his coat. Out of view of the distracted guards, Max Hanley eased the bomb from the false bottom of his valise. The explosive device was smaller than a compact disc case, a marvel of miniaturization that packed the detonative force of a Claymore mine. 5 feet from the staircase, the smoker got to his feet and descended to the deck level. Wan had banked on the man remaining seated next to his partner. Damn, Murphy. He accepted the proffered cigarette and held it for the guard to light with his prized Zippo. Wan took a measured drag, held the smoke in his mouth for a second, then exploded in a wrenching cough, as if the tobacco was harsher than he'd anticipated. The guard chuckled at Cabrillo's discomfort and flicked his attention to his partner to make a comment. He never saw that Cabrillo's coughing fit had allowed him to torque his body like a coiled spring, so when Wan threw the punch, it contained every ounce of strength in his 6-foot-1-inch frame. The blow landed on the point of the guard's jaw and corkscrewed him to the deck as though he'd been shot. Wan couldn't believe the reflexes of the second guard. He'd anticipated at least 2 seconds for him to even realize what was happening.
Instead, the man was already up at the top of the short flight of steps and was just reaching into his shoulder holster when Cabrillo dove for him. Juan jumped for the stairs, reaching for the man's ankles. The automatic's barrel had just cleared the holster when Cabrillo's hands closed around the Korean's shins. Cabrillo fell heavily onto the steel steps, gashing his chin on a sharp edge, but his momentum pulled the North Korean off balance, sending him tumbling backwards. The gun clattered onto the upper landing. Cabrillo scrambled to his feet, blood running from his chin, adrenaline surging in his veins. Even if the Korean couldn't aim the pistol, the sound of a single shot would alert Kim and call an army of security guards to the vessel. Behind the grappling men, Max Hanley had raced to the missile destined to blast the holy city of Mecca. He had to set the bomb close enough to the warhead to cause a sympathetic detonation. Hali Kasim pulled the stiletto hidden in the binding of his Quran and ran for the stairs, knowing the fight would be over before reaching his boss, but making the effort nevertheless. Juan tried to smash his elbow into the Korean's groin as he clawed his way up the stairs. The blow missed as the lithe guard twisted, and he felt his right arm go numb from the elbow down as it smashed into the deck plate. He cursed and managed to grab the man's right wrist just before his fingers curled around the gun. Even with his superior size and strength, Cabrillo was in an awkward position, and he felt the Korean draw closer to the weapon. Hale was 10 feet from the steps when the guard made a lunge for the pistol. Juan allowed himself to be thrown with the man's desperate grab, and his useless right arm arced like a pendulum into the side of the Korean's head, stunning him for a moment. The guard shook off the blow and kicked at Juan's right leg, slamming it against a railing. What sounded like the crack of broken bone echoed over the labored breathing of the combatants. The guard was sure the Syrian was finished and turned his attention back to getting the weapon. But Cabrillo wasn't even fazed. As the Korean grabbed the barrel of his pistol, Juan grasped his wrist and smashed it repeatedly against the deck. On the third blow, the automatic flew from his grip and bounced down the steps. Hali scooped it up, mounted the stairs 3 at a time, and clipped the guard on the side of the head with the butt. The Korean's eyes fluttered, and he was out. "You okay, boss?" Kasim asked, helping Cabrillo to his feet. Max bounded up the stairs with the speed of a man half his age. "Ask him later. Bomb's ticking and we have 15 minutes. Familiar with all manner of ships, the three men ran unerringly to the main deck where they paused for just a moment to make sure there were no guards patrolling the area. They could see the sleek destroyer in the middle of the bay, her turret-mounted 100-millimeter guns trained on the outer harbor. There was no one on deck, so the three rushed to the railing and unceremoniously tossed themselves overboard. The water was cold and tasted like kerosene soup. Max spat a mouthful as he slid his robe over his head. Beneath it, he wore a pair of swim trunks and a tight thermal top. Juan struggled out of his boots but left his uniform on. He'd grown up in the surf of Southern California and was as comfortable in the water as on dry land. Hali, the youngest of the assault team, shed his jacket and kicked off his brogans, forcing them under the black surface. They swam silently to the ship's fantail and ducked under her curved hull so as not to be spotted from above. There was a balance between speed and stealth. Eddie could have kept the 32-foot Discovery 1000 submerged, and the men could have cycled through the airlock, a time-consuming process even in the best circumstance. Juan had decided that Eddie should broach the sub so the men could climb through her topside hatch. They would be visible for no more than 30 seconds and surfacing near the acoustical clutter of waves striking the Asia Star's idle prop and rudder would mask any sounds from Korean detection gear. The wait was no more than a minute before bubbles erupted directly astern of the Asia Star. They were in motion even before the mini-sub's flat upper works broke through the waves. Hali reached the sub first and swung himself aboard. He was working the hatch cover as water sluiced off the sub's matte black hull. The seal broke with an audible hiss, and he threw himself down into the dark confines of the sub, followed closely by Max and Juan. Cabrillo and Max had the hatch resealed an instant later, working by feel more than sight, since the only light in the Discovery 1000 came from the faint glow of electronics in the forward cockpit. Juan hit a switch midway up a bulkhead, and a pair of red blackout lights snapped on. The Discovery wasn't designed to dive much below 100 feet and could operate for no more than 24 hours without recharging and replacing the CO2 filters. For this mission, her seating for 8 had been removed to make room for racks of batteries, bulky industrial boxes joined with a snaking nest of wiring conduits. Crates of filters were crammed in the other available spaces, as well as provisions for Eddie Tseng. A chemical toilet sat amid a clutter of empty food cartons. The air was heavy with humidity and carried a locker room funk. Eddie had been alone on the sub since launching off the Oregon 15 days earlier. With the harbor ringed with underwater listening stations and routinely swept with active sonar, it had taken that long for Tseng to drift into the heavily defended port. He had grounded the sub during the slight ebb tide and allowed her to drift when the tidal surge washed into the harbor, only chancing to run the electric motors under the cover of an inbound ship or patrol boat. There was no other way to get the sub into the naval base without being detected. While there were other sub drivers among the Oregon crew, as director of shore operations, Eddie wouldn't let anyone else take the risk. Tseng was another veteran of the CIA, although Juan hadn't known him when they were in the agency. He'd spent most of his career working the Middle East, while Eddie had been attached to the American Embassy in Beijing, running several successful spy networks. Budget and policy shifts following September 11th had seen him transferred to a stateside desk. Still hungry for what he called the teeth of the trade, Tseng had joined the corporation and quickly established himself as an indispensable member. Cabrillo crawled over batteries and empty crates and slid into the co-pilot seat to Eddie's right. Eddie's black hair was lank from going so long without washing, and stubble marred his otherwise sharp features. The emotional and physical strain of the past 2 weeks had dimmed his normally bright eyes. "Hiya, boss," Tseng grinned. Nothing could diminish his easygoing charm. "Welcome aboard." "Thanks," Juan said, noting that the sub had already descended to 30 feet. "The clock's ticking, so set a course out of the harbor and punch it. We've got 11 minutes. The Discovery's motors ramped up and the single prop bit into the water. There was nothing they could do about the noise. They had to get as far from the Asia Star as possible because water does not compress, making the coming shockwave doubly brutal. Cabrillo kept his eyes on the sub's sonar, and only a minute after they began pulling away from the doomed freighter, there was contact. "Mr. Murphy's rearing his ugly head." "What do you have?" Hanley stood just behind Juan and leaned over his shoulder. The computer analyzed the acoustical signal, and Cabrillo read the grim facts. "Sinpo-class patrol boat. Crew of 12. Armed with a pair of 37mm autocannons and tilt racks for depth charges. Top speed is 40 knots, and our contact is already churning 20 and headed straight for us." Eddie turned to Juan. "It's routine. They've been doing this ever since I entered the harbor. Every couple of hours, a single patrol boat races along the dock. I think they're searching for sailors trying to jump ship. If he maintains his course, he's going to pass right over us." "Does that class of boats carry sonar?" Max asked. Juan checked the computer again. "Doesn't say." "What do you want me to do?" Eddie's voice remained calm and professional. "Keep running, or settle onto the bottom and let him pass?" Cabrillo checked his watch again. They'd traveled little more than a quarter mile. Too close. "Keep going. If he hears us or detects our wake, he's going to have to slow and turn back to try to find us again. We only need 6 minutes." A moment later, the four men inside the mini-sub could hear the thrash of the patrol boat's props through the water, an angry sound that rose in pitch as the craft drew closer. As it roared overhead, the din filled the hull, and the men waited expectantly to hear if it would come back for another pass. the moment stretched as time turned elastic. Max and Holly let out their breaths as the patrol boat continued on. Cabrillo kept his eyes glued to the sonar screen.
"They're turning," he remarked a second later. "Coming back for another look. Holly, check the radio. See if he's transmitting."
Holly Kasim headed the Oregon's communications division and could play radios like a concert pianist. The communications suite aboard the Oregon was sophisticated enough to scan and record 1,000 frequencies per second and had a language program that could translate fast enough for an operator to hold a conversation close enough to real time to fool most listeners. With the Discovery 1000's limited electronics, they would be lucky just to pick up a broadcast, and since none of the men spoke Korean, they wouldn't know if the patrol craft was asking permission to depth charge or commenting on the weather.
"I'm not getting anything," Kasim answered after a few moments.
The North Korean patrol boat crossed over the mini-sub again, and the men heard her engines throttle back.
"They're pacing us," Eddie said.
The powerful sonar picked up a pair of splashes too small to be depth charges. Juan knew immediately what was about to happen.
"Brace yourselves!"
The grenades were knockoffs of the Soviet RGD-5, and while they only contained 4 ounces of high explosives, the water amplified their explosive power. The two grenades went off nearly simultaneously just yards behind the Discovery. The sub pitched up by the stern, knocking Holly Kasim against a bank of batteries. Eddie fought to bring her nose up as the murky bottom suddenly loomed outside the large acrylic viewport. With their ears ringing, no one heard a second pair of grenades hit the water. They blew just above the mini-sub, slamming her into the mud just as Eddie got her on an even keel. Billows of silt exploded around the Discovery, cutting visibility to zero. Electricity arced and snapped from a loose connection in dazzlingly bright flashes that temporarily blinded the men. Eddie quickly powered down the sub to give Max a chance to fix the connection. By the glow of a miniature flashlight clamped between his teeth, the engineer worked to bypass the affected row of batteries, but the damage had been done. The flashes of electricity could be seen from the surface through the sub's portholes and looked like an eerie blue glow from the depths.
"They've got us now," Holly said. "They're transmitting something. Just a short message, but I think the jig is up."
"How's it coming, Max?" Cabrillo inquired with no more concern than if he were asking when coffee would be ready.
"Just a few more seconds."
"Anything from shore yet, Holly?"
"Negative. The brass must be mulling over the report from the patrol boat."
"Got it," Max announced. "Eddie, turn her back on." Eddie Sang hit a button, and the display screens lit with their muted glimmer.
"Okay, Eddie. Emergency blow. Bring us to the surface."
"The patrol boat's right above us, boss."
Cabrillo's response was a dark smile.
"There goes our warranty,"
Eddie muttered, then blew ballast from the Discovery's tanks with compressed air. The little sub seemed to launch itself from the bottom. He watched the depth gauge and called out the numbers. When he said there were only 5 feet of water over the disco's top deck, all 4 men instinctively ducked lower in their seats. The steel hull slammed into the underside of the North Korean craft with a deafening screech. The sub was several tons lighter than the patrol boat, but her upward momentum tipped the Koreans until their starboard rail was in the water. One crewman had his legs crushed when he was pitched over the side by a rolling fuel drum. Juan reached across Eddie and punched the command for a crash dive before the upper deck broke the surface. High-speed pumps filled the ballast tanks in under 15 seconds, and the Discovery dropped like a stone.
"That ought to keep him busy for a few minutes," Max said.
"We only need a few."
"Okay, everyone, get your earphones on and strap in."
The men donned bulky headsets that they jacked into a piece of electronics specially installed for the mission. Built by Sound Answers, the experimental noise-canceling device took in sound waves, evaluated their frequency and amplitude, and played back the exact opposite sound, nullifying 99% of the decibels. Such devices, once perfected and miniaturized, would soon make it possible for silent vacuum cleaners and end the anxiety of listening to a dentist's drill. Aboard the Asia Star, one of the North Korean spies sent to guard the Syrians had come to. He wasted precious seconds checking on his partner. The lump where he'd been clipped with the pistol was as tight as a drum. The man wouldn't awaken. The guard knew his duty. He ran from the hold, shouting at the top of his lungs, ignoring the pain it caused in his head. He ran up to the main deck, checking doors along the corridor behind the bridge until he found the captain's. He considered knocking, but what he had to report was too important. He burst through the door. General Kim was on the telephone.
"And then what will you do to my little Lotus?"
Kim snapped to his feet when the door crashed against the cabin wall. He roared, "What is the meaning of this?"
"General," the guard panted, "the Syrians, they attacked us. I did not see them in the hold. I think they might be trying to escape."
"Escape? Escape what?"
Kim no sooner asked those questions when he realized the answer. He cut the connection to his mistress, pounding on the reset lever to alert the shore operator.
"Come on, you damn thing," he cursed, then addressed the guard.
"They weren't Syrians. They were American saboteurs.
Search the hold for a bomb."
Finally, a voice sounded in the telephone. Kim knew that even if he died, getting a warning out would make sure the Americans would pay for their treachery.
"This is General Kim aboard the Asia Star."
At the back corner of the hold, Max's bomb wound down to zero. The bomb blast tore through the missile where it had been hidden and an instant later caused a secondary explosion of the warhead. Overpressure built inside the hold until the 4-ton hatches blew into the night sky as though a volcano had erupted. The Star's old hull plates split at their welds like peels from an orange as the tons of rocket fuel stored in her forward hold detonated. The ship disintegrated. A 700-foot wedge of the concrete dock shattered, and chunks of it were thrown miles inland. The two massive loading cranes along the wharf toppled into the water, and every window along the harbor was blown to pieces. Then the shockwave spread. Warehouses were blown flat for a quarter mile, and those farther away were stripped of their siding so only their skeletal steel frames remained upright. The concussion stripped the first 6 feet of water from the bay and piled it into a wave that slammed the destroyer lying at anchor, breaking her keel and capsizing her so fast that none of her harbor watch had time to react. Night turned to day as the fireball climbed to 1,100 feet and sheets of rocket fuel fell like burning rain, setting fires all around the Navy Yard, while bits of the Asia Star's hull scythed through the base like shrapnel, leveling buildings and wrecking vehicles. The concussion plucked the floundering patrol boat from the sea and sent it tumbling across the surface of the bay, rolling it like a log down a mountainside. With each revolution, more of her upper works tore free. First it was her 4 gun mounts, then the pair of 50 calibers at her stern, and finally her small cabin came apart, leaving just her hull to barrel roll atop the waves. The noise dampener did its job, but still the concussion wave rang through the Discovery 1000 as though she was a bell. The whole hull shook as the shockwave passed over, and the plucky little sub lurched forward, then ebbed violently, straining the safety straps and scattering loose equipment from storage bins. Eardrums were brutally assaulted by the blast, and had it not been for the counter-frequencies channeled into the headsets, the 4 men would have been permanently deafened. As it was, Cabrillo had to shout at the top of his lungs to inquire about his men. Eddie and Holly were unscathed, but Max had taken a bump on the head from a falling battery. The skin hadn't broken, and he hadn't been knocked out. He'd suffer a headache for a while, and it would take days for the knot already forming to subside.
"All right, Eddie, take us home."
The mini-sub slipped out of the harbor undetected and was 2 miles from the coast before they picked up helicopters thundering toward Osan. The choppers were flying too high and too fast to be ASW, anti-submarine warfare birds.
They were most likely rescue helos ferrying medical supplies and personnel to the devastated base. Like all other coastal nations on Earth, North Korea was afforded 12 miles of ocean as sovereign territory. Just to play it safe, Juan Cabrillo had scheduled the rendezvous for 20 miles out, a long slog in the reeking confines of the Discovery that took nearly 3 hours longer than planned. The Discovery had to stay deep as dawn approached in case the North Koreans did send out aerial reconnaissance. At last, they came to the spot of ocean, and Eddie eased the craft up from 80 feet where she'd remained hidden. The underside of the Oregon's hull was coated with red anti-fouling paint and loomed over the small sub. Juan noted with pride that the hull was clear of barnacles and looked as new as the day he'd taken possession of her. In order to take advantage of the tremendous power generated by her revolutionary engines, the Oregon utilized an MDV design as perfected by high-speed European express ferries. Her monohull deep V arrangement allowed her to knife through the seas at unheard-of speeds. To maintain stability, she sported several retractable T-foils and fins, undersea wings that kept her planing smoothly at up to 40 knots. Beyond that speed, the wings produced too much drag. They were drawn back to the hull, and the crew had to strap themselves in like offshore hydroplane racers. Eddie grabbed a device the size and shape of a garage door remote, pointed it up at the Oregon, and pressed the single button. Splitting at the keel, a pair of 80-foot-long doors hinged downward. Bright light from inside the ship filtered through the water and bathed the underside of the ship in a green glow. Eddie nudged the thrusters and adjusted the ballast, centering the Discovery in the opening. He held station just below the hull as two men in scuba gear jumped from inside the ship and attached lift cables to hardpoints fore and aft. The mini-sub and its larger sister, a Nomad 1000 also kept aboard the Oregon, could surface directly into the moon pool, but the maneuver was risky and used only in emergencies. The frogman swam in front of the viewport and gave Eddie and Juan a wave, then slashed his hand across his neck. Eddie killed the motors. A second later, the sub lurched, then began to rise smoothly into the flooded moon pool. As it cleared the surface, Seng opened valves so the ballast tanks could drain. Juan spotted Julia Huxley, the Oregon's medical officer, standing at the edge of the pool with a pair of orderlies. He shot her a thumbs up, and her concerned frown turned into a smile. She'd joined the corporation after a career in the Navy, finishing with a 4-year stint as the chief medical officer at San Diego Naval Base. Under her lab coat, the 5'3" Julia was curvaceous without running to fat. He rarely saw her dark hair out of a ponytail, and the only makeup she used was to highlight her soft, dark eyes. The overhead crane lowered the sub onto a cradle, and a workman clambered on top to crank open the outer hatch. When it finally released, the crew inside heard him gasp.
"Whoa!"
"Try being sealed inside for a week," Eddie called, pulling himself from his seat. He'd already unzipped the front of his jumpsuit in preparation for his first shower in 15 days. His chest and stomach were so lean that individual muscle fibers were visible. Eddie was built like famed martial artist Bruce Lee, and like Lee, was a master in several Eastern fighting techniques. Juan allowed his men to precede him out, but as soon as he'd taken his first deep breaths, he called to a sailor nearby,
"Get these doors closed, and contact Eric in the control room. Have him set a course due east, say 20 knots. As long as the threat board remains green, there's no need to draw attention to ourselves by opening her up."
Eric Stone was a control room operator, the ship's best, and the only man Juan wanted at the helm during critical operations.
"Aye, sir."
When the doors were closed, pumps came online to drain the moon pool, and workers laid decking grills over the hole. Technicians were already assessing the damage caused when the Discovery rammed the patrol boat, while others were bringing gallon jugs of bleach to sanitize the interior. Julia approached Juan when he came down the ladder from the top of the mini-sub.
"We heard the explosion out here, so I don't need to ask how it went."
"You don't sound too happy about it."
Juan stripped off his Colonel Harani uniform coat.
"Just bored, Mr. Chairman.
Other than a few strained muscles, I haven't had much to do in months.
Juan smiled.
I thought that was a good thing for a doctor.
For a doctor, yes.
For an employee, it's Dullsville.
Come on, Julia, you know us.
Give it a few days or a week and we'll get into some sort of trouble.
Cabrillo would soon regret those words. In just 96 hours, Dr. Julia Huxley was going to be literally up to her elbows in work.